Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Joining me to perform the British public service of not talking at length about Brexit as parliamentary democracy topples around our ears is the citizen of Europe herself, Thea Lenarduzzi. Ciao, Thea.
Ciao.
Do you say ciao, don't you?
Me?
No, one, to
one,
say hello.
Yes.
Yeah, ciao.
And I do also.
I was going to ask you, because we talked about ball sports today, didn't we?
Yes.
And you said, what's the phrase you used about you were unlucky with balls or something like that? And it made me...
A magnet for balls. I think what I said.
We were
specifically my head.
Yes, your head was a magnet for balls because we were talking about injuries that one can get with sports. I have a son who's constantly... Where did it come from? How did we start down that road? Can you remember?
I really genuinely cannot remember.
The conversation ended with Thea saying magnet for balls, and I thought, oh, I'll mention that because it brought me good cheer, and I hope it has you.
It's better than talking about Brexit.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, the thing is, that is a test that can be passed by almost anything, I would imagine. Make sure you're all doing your bit to support transcontinental culture. Google TLS subscriptions and join our merry little gang. We've published some good stuff this year, I promise. Coming up this week, the sexy world of social psychology, those inventive experiments that teach us in shocking fashion about our common inhumanity. But how much is it the preserve of hucksters and headline chasers? Andrew Scull weighs in with some thoughts. And as part of our translation special, Boyd Tonkin joins us to discuss his review of a book promising 100 of the finest short stories ever translated. Hubristic talk, surely. He'll let us know.
Boyd Tonkin begins his review this week of a collection of 100 short stories gathered from around the world and translated into English by pointing out that this impulse to grasp and to survey the entire planet of words is not as new as some of us might think when observing publishing trends. The efforts of Goethe and his disciples to forge a notion of world literature are, Boyd says, early expressions of that ambition. And ambition is the right word. The editor of the present volume, Frank Wynne, himself a translator, has drawn from 33 languages and 4 centuries of material. And the result is undoubtedly a wonderful thing, as well as an opportunity for us to talk about the health of literature in translation more broadly. If studies citing a 96% rise in sales of translated fiction between 2001 and 2015 are to be believed, a collection such as this will be all too enthusiastically received by Anglophone readers. But consider also that, according to a recent report in 2011, all translations published and distributed in the UK and Ireland represent only around 3%, compared to around 12% in Germany, around 16% in France, and just shy of 20% in Italy. Then, More anecdotally, we might also observe that in the UK, and leaving the TLS out of it for now, literature in translation seems still to be set aside, on its own shelf somewhere, usually towards the back of the bigger bookshops. Some critics have referred to the ghettoisation of translated literature. Here to shed light on all of this is Boyd Tonkin. Before we go any further, I should point out that long before the Man Booker International and in the US the National Book Awards new category last year for translated literature came the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize. That was founded in 1990, and you were behind that.
Well, I was behind its revival. Yes, it had a little period of abeyance in the late 1990s. And then in 2001, we had some really stalwart support from Arts Council England, and we could start it up again. And I'm glad to say it more or less expanded from then on.
And you also, I mean, that sort of then merged with the Man Booker International.
It merged in 2015. And what was really significant about that coming together was that the Man Booker International Prize then started to offer the same prize money, £50,000, as the Man Booker Prize in English. And this was, I think, an important piece of symbolism. It was showing that the International Prize, the prize for translated literature, was as important, had parity of esteem and also parity of reward.
But is that a convenient fiction to make everyone feel better? Because in reality, the Booker Prize in English, the English one, is the one that agents care about, is the one that's heralded by people and gets all the coverage.
It's a long haul,
yeah,
and you start somewhere, and I think it's a very important place to start. We've heard the figures about translations in the English-speaking world. They are improving. They're not improving as fast as one would want. But in terms of impact, of attractiveness to readers, the degree to which books can create a buzz, even a sensation, I don't think we've been doing too badly. In fact, one of the problems of translation in Britain, certainly, is that the field tends to be dominated each year, each couple of years, by the next generation of superstars and talking points, whether it's Elena Ferrante or Carlo Veconoscar, or we've just had the coverage of the latest novel by Michel Houellebecq, which isn't even translated yet.
Yeah.
And one of the problems of trying to get people to read more fiction in translation is simply finding the best way to normalize it. So in other words, the translated author is not an exotic rarity. It's not like some tropical fruit that suddenly lands in your local greengrocer, but it's something that you naturally and enjoyably consume month in, month out.
But we're sort of torn, though, aren't we? Because we while not wanting to draw attention to the foreignness of it so that people don't feel nervous about it and bookshops can put it up front, we also have to recognise it so that we can recognise the tremendous achievement involved in bringing it there, so that's the translators, the editors.
Yeah, it's a very interesting paradox. Of course, you have to celebrate the art of the translator. You have to reward them properly. You have to give them prizes, which they certainly deserve. But on the other hand, after all, these are books which ordinary readers will come across because they like the idea of the original text. They're not necessarily going to be attracted by the excellence of the translation as a primary motive. That's not invariably true. I can think of translators, for instance, the sadly late Anthea Bell, whose consistent record of excellence was really so extraordinary that people would be drawn to books that she had translated by her name rather than the original author's name. But that, I think, is a very uncommon occurrence.
And it's a different qualitative experience, isn't it, when you're reading a translation? Because when you're reading the original, you know you're dealing with things like authorial intent, you're dealing with a verbal texture that you know has a certain source. And then when you're reading a translated book, you don't know whether the effects you're experiencing, particularly if you don't speak the original language, you've got no sense of comparing to the original text. You don't know whether you're experiencing a turn of phrase that is the product of the translator. I think Martin Amis said trying to separate that out is trying to find brush strokes in a brownie. It's a different product you've kind of got at the end of it. Does that not affect how you read and how you seek to enjoy the words, or is that overthinking it a little bit?
Well, it's important if you're a specialist. I don't think it's important if you're just looking for a good novel to read. The question of translation as interpretation is what I would want to emphasize here. In the same way that a performance of Beethoven's Eroica, like the one I heard a couple of days ago, is a very singular, time-bound version of whatever the composer's original intentions were. So all translations, especially translations of the literature of the past, is equally a creative interpretation, but a creative interpretation which is rooted in what we know of the intentions, the choices, the structural underpinnings of the original.
I feel like we've come quite a long way in recognising that, though. If you compare, I think perhaps in its search, and you know, perhaps it needed to happen, translators needed to find their way of gaining recognition for their craft. But certainly in the 90s, it seemed that translation seemed to get a bit bogged down in the theory of translating and, you know, whether to maintain a foreign term or to nativise it or all that sort of thing, whether the translator should be a creator or invisible.
Yes.
Whereas
yes.
Now we seem to have moved beyond that and they meet as creative minds in, you know, in the ether or whatever
I think so. Much as I admire the complexity and difficulty and artistry of translation, I have to say that if you start reading those debates about nativizing and foreignizing tendencies, then you will lose the will to live, let alone to read translation. Having said that, clearly, there is a particular gradient that every translator worth their salt must take. And at its summit is a peculiar kind of exchange or dialogue with the original. One of the greatest theoretical expressions of this is Walter Benjamin's famous essay, The Task of the Translator, where he also almost implies that that in some strange celestial realm there is a language which is not the language of the original, and it is not the language of the translation, but somehow it is its own thing. Mm. And it happens when there is that curious alchemy, that meeting of minds or spirits between the first text and the intentions of the translator.
Do you think reviews can be a little ungenerous then when they look at translations? Because, you know, we publish lots of reviews of translated works, and in a very considerable number of them, this is the idiom in Italian, this is the effortful way in which the translators tried to turn it into English, and the effect is off-putting and quaint and all. And bearing in mind that it is effectively impossible to translate an idiom between languages at one level, yeah. Do you think that we collectively, when we write about translators, is there a bit lack of generosity?
It is curious, because translators are always saying to me and to everyone else involved in this business that reviews should reflect a more profound engagement with the quality of the translation. But as you say, when that happens, it isn't always to the translator's benefit. No. In fact, it's a lot easier to nitpick. It's a lot easier to find faults than it is to praise the overall tone or structure of an effective translation. And I have to say that this is perhaps the moment where we should mention that bad translations can have a very important role in cultural history as well. Everyone aspires to perfection, to total seamless reflection of the original text's intentions. But if you look at literary history, the history of fiction, of poetry, of scriptural translation, it is often the imprecise translations, the most committed and earliest translations that have the greatest effect.
And is that to do with their quality or to do with their getting on the scene first?
Partly it's to do with precedence. Yeah. In other words, the first translation of a book will establish that book in the target language, irrespective of its potential faults, irrespective of the fact that someone might produce a more scholarly, reflective, considered version later. There's a kind of canonical example of this, which is the reception of Thomas Mann in English. And Mann's novels were translated very early very promptly, very rapidly, by a lady called Helen Lowe Porter. And it is axiomatic in the business of German translation that in many ways she wasn't that good. She wasn't a punctilious translator. Her linguistic knowledge seems to have been defective in many ways. However, Thomas Mann thoroughly approved of what she was doing. He was very keen to get into the English and American markets as quickly as possible. He endorsed her translations. And I have to say that it is those translations that first introduced me to Mann. Mm-hmm. So my magic mountain is Helen Lowe Porter's magic mountain, for all its potential drawbacks. And it still has an absolutely stupendous narrative power.
It's interesting in a sense because if a novel's published, you don't expect a second revised edition to come out.
Yeah.
Whereas translations, they need to be revised in a sense. Because I'm thinking this week we have a review of Cesare Pavese. I think it's Penguin have just reissued La Bella Estate, and it's the translation from the 1950s, yeah. And it suffers for not having been updated. And people who read the English version of that story now.
It's full of blighters and what the dickens. Yes.
Exactly. It just, yeah. you lose it. You've sort of lost the work there. It needs to be updated for a new generation.
That's a very, very important point, the degree to which translations age and date faster than their originals.
And why is that? Because actually, at one level, that's surprising, because there's a piece of work written in the 1950s in Italian that should date in the same way as a piece of text written in the English in the 1950s, shouldn't it?
I'm not exactly sure why it happens, but it becomes a very, very significant factor when you want to recommend translations to people who might not know an author. It was something that I came across very, very frequently when I was compiling my book of my own choice of 100 translations. And I found that there were wonderful authors whom I couldn't in all conscience advocate because the translations had really, they had a whiff of the back shelf in the forgotten library to them. This was true, for instance, of some wonderful Scandinavian writers. Selma Lagerlöf, the great Swedish writer, Nobel Prize winner, a wonderful novel of hers called Jerusalem, about Swedish migrants to the Holy Land at the turn of the 20th century. A very important novel, pioneering in many ways, but it hasn't been translated, to my knowledge, for really quite a few decades. And the versions that you can come across, and it will take you a lot of effort to find them, are really not things that you would want to recommend to a new generation of readers.
Is that the question that when you're translating, you're already putting an idiom under an awful lot of pressure? So in some ways, by taking a piece of slang in Italian and putting it in English, there's already a strain there. And so that then left for 50 years. It's not going to be, it's never going to have been natural English to begin with. So maybe that's why it's prematurely aged in the second language.
And of course, you mention a separate and also very important issue here, which is the way that informal colloquial language is, in a way, subject to more rapid obsolescence than what you might call classical educated speech. This again is something I dealt with when making my own selection. But in one instance, I was really saved by the bell, because a novel I love is Döblin's Berlin Alexanderplatz, first translated in 1931 by a guy called Eugene Jolas, who was a friend of Joyce and Pound, who was quite an important figure on the Parisian literary scene at the time. But he produced a very slangy 1931 translation of this great novel of the Weimar Republic, which really often sounds like the dialogue in an early Hitchcock film. If you can imagine, I don't know, Harry Enfield's version of a Cockney accent from a 1930s film, then you get 500 pages of that in Jolas's version of Berlin Alexanderplatz. So rather sadly, I was thinking I would have to leave it out. And then, just in the nick of time, along came Michael Hoffman. With his amazingly vigorous and supple and dynamic new version of Berlin Alexanderplatz. But again, you have to wonder, in 30 or 40 years' time,
how will that date?
How much of that slang will appear very quaint and very outdated.
We had him in the we had the introduction in the paper of that, and it's and maybe he's a poet, so maybe that he has a sense of the tenor and value of words more than a prose writer. Maybe that will have an impact on it. Who knows?
Let's talk about Frank Wynne's collection before we don't. So it sounds like a wonderful collection. As you said, it's an ambitious thing. So what does he give us a sense of his criteria or his methodology?
Well, I think he's basically looking for great stories, but he's also looking for a much wider spread geographically and culturally than is often the case in anthologies of translated literature. We could touch here on the issue of how far the entire translation game has been very Eurocentric enterprise. And Frank is, I think, very deliberately and honourably trying to push some of those boundaries so that you have a much wider range of languages and geographical origins than you would do in a traditional anthology of this kind, everywhere from Korea to Iceland to Argentina.
Oh, and he's a translator from Spanish as well, isn't he?
He's a translator from Spanish as well as French, which of course opens up much of Latin America to him as well.
And you don't mind, because you've done your own book, 100 Best Novels in Translation, there's always going to be the slight charge of not quite hubris, in this case, hubris, 100 of the finest short stories ever translated as a subtitle.
Provocative.
And do we just forgive him because it's just a marketing technique to get
the
book read?
I grappled with this, but basically, your readers are grown-ups. They know that this is an intellectual exercise, but it's also crucially an invitation to debate.
Yeah.
Of course, part of the whole idea is that people should say, why is such and such a writer or such and such a story excluded? And if it makes readers think more seriously about what they rate, what they love, how they would construct their own personal canons, then that's all to the good.
Well, in that spirit then, who were you thrilled to see and who did you miss?
Well, I was thrilled to see some of the writers, as we were saying, from beyond Europe. For instance, the remarkable Japanese woman writer Ichio Higuchi, whom I really hadn't read before, a real discovery from the late 19th century. Wonderful stories from, for instance, the Catalan writer Mercè Rodoreda, from Urdu Isma Chuktai, from Japanese selection of tremendous writers, Akutagawa, Mishima, Chinese writers whom I didn't really know, such as Shi Shi, another woman writer for whom this was a real revelation.
And if you don't know there's a chance of most people not knowing. And it's nice, isn't it, to find a writer that you would have to be introduced by someone else to a writer.
Yes, yeah. Because obviously this happens to me, this happens to everyone who compiles any kind of anthology or selection. The easiest form of review is simply to list the omissions.
And you didn't do that. It's a very kind review. That's exactly right.
But there are some...
Go on.
Okay, there are some fantastic writers who Frank could have included. For instance, Eileen Chang, a wonderful Chinese short story writer. Close to home, this is another issue I dealt with and I think rather fumbled with in my own book. I think we need to realise that there is a wonderful literature in the British Isles, not written in English.
Welsh.
So, for instance, the terrific Welsh short story writer Kate Roberts could have been in Frank's anthology in the same way that, for instance, a Welsh writer like Caradog Pritchard could have been in my book.
Is there an argument that because Welsh was a very oral storytelling culture, that at some level, either consciously or subconsciously, we have not valued its literature, its written down stories, because we kind of associate Eisteddfod's music and bardic nature of Welsh. We don't necessarily, in our own minds, think of it as having a canon of written literature.
Well, that, I think that's true, but you could say the same for the written literature from many other parts of the world. If you look at, for instance, the oral storytelling tradition in many parts of Africa or the Middle East or Asia, there is the same, as you said, a kind of intellectual mismatch between recognizing that this tradition is powerful and living and thriving, and acknowledging that it has also given rise to a remarkable form of written literature as well. So, but I think that there's a general tendency not to want to know about the literature of Welsh or Irish or Scottish Gaelic. That, I think, is one of the many metropolitan prejudices that we should seek to get over.
And this book and your book and actually, generally speaking, caring about translation is one way of achieving a response to insularity, to prejudice in its broadest sense.
Well, yes, of course, literature is not the world, and translated literature has enormous blind spots and grey areas. So however much you consume of it, however much you appreciate it, there will always be terrain which is undiscovered. For me, one of the great absences in the English tradition of translation is how little contemporary or recent literature comes to us from the Indian subcontinent. Partly it's because we think we know Indian or Pakistani or Sri Lankan literature because there are so many fantastic writers in English. And because of this, agents and publishers think that they don't really need to look further. They don't really need to find out what's happening in Bengali or Urdu or Tamil or Kannada or Hindi. But in all of those languages and many others, there is a flourishing tradition of prose fiction. And it would be nice to feel that we were getting just a little more of it here.
The task has been set. Duncan, thank you very much.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
From the 50s to the 70s, there was a rise of prominent social psychological experiments that got everyone excited. Stanley Milgram of Yale showed that people under the influence of authority figures would be willing to administer fatal electric shocks. There was the Stanford Prison Experiment, in which folk were randomly allocated roles of guards and prisoners, and the power-abusing brutality of the former was quick to follow. Gina Perry has written a book about another, called The Robber's Cave Experiment by Muzaffar Sherif, which involved children being manipulated into hostile activity in the manner of the Lord of the Flies. How much of this is based on opportunism or snake oil? And what about a later, different figure like Martin Seligman, who has produced a memoir charting his journey from helplessness to optimism? Andrew Scull, a renowned skeptic, to put it mildly, has looked into all of this in the TLS and joins us now. Andrew, hello.
Hello.
Can we go back to why there was this rise, I suppose, of these sort of quite showy, very narrative-driven experiments?
It is very interesting, and as I look at the experiments you've laid out, and also David Rosenhan's piece on how pseudo patients got themselves into mental hospitals. One of the strands that connects them, I think, is they're all written by young academics at the beginning of their career, who are clearly very ambitious. They're all very flamboyant kinds of figures. They seize on this kind of work, which in a way confirms people's fears to build their own careers. And Sharif is lucky because he concocts his experiment, and I say that advisedly because he actually creates his own findings according to a script almost. That emerges at almost exactly the same time as William Golding's Lord of the Flies. That's a coincidence, but it's not something that does Sharif any harm. If you look at the Zimbardo prison experiment, that's just after the Attica prison rising in New York, where the prisoners fight the guards, there's mass killing. And of course, Milgram is about the same time as the Eichmann trial. So these are people who are tapping into something that's going on at the same time.
So is it a question? I mean, one of the criticisms of Freud is he's almost a better novelist than he was a scientist because of his desire to create story. And it feels, reading your account of these, and we'll get to the Robber's Cave experiment shortly, they're driven by story rather than necessarily by science. Is that a fair criticism, do you think?
I certainly think so. And Gina Perry, for all that I didn't like the approach she took in dealing with the Robber's Cave experiment, inventing what was going on in people's minds and that sort of thing, this is the second bite she's had at this particular problem. She went back and reviewed all the original Milgram audio tapes and documents, and it was clear that Milgram's experiment, rather than being about obedience to authority, is much more about how people can be bullied into behaviors they otherwise probably wouldn't engage in. So over and over again, when these experiments are probed, they turn out to have been a kind of orchestrated storytelling, exactly as you just mentioned, which resonates very powerfully because of the picture it draws of human beings, which is often not a very flattering one. But they're extremely unethical experiments, almost without exception.
Well, tell us about the Robber's Cave, because explain it to us, because it involves implausibly a plan to set an entire forest on fire, it seems. What's it setting out to do? What are the parameters of it?
Well, what the Robber's Cave is about, and it's research that the Rockefeller Foundation funded by the standards of the time, quite a lot of money to do it, and he tried initially an experiment that never saw the light of day, really, until Gina Perry came along. He set up an experiment originally in upstate New York, in the countryside, and he brought together groups of boys aged about 11, and he let them start to make friendships. And then he broke up each dyad. So one early friend, they didn't know one another before the experiment, they were assigned to two different teams, and then the teams were kind of set against one another. And the intent was to try to create as much vicious behavior and rivalry as possible. And in order to do that, the adults who were supposedly supervising them often engaged in some pretty outrageous behavior that was disguised as coming from the other group of boys, the competing group of boys. And this wasn't the first round of experiment was really intended, first of all, to create this kind of viciousness, and so to show human beings were evil. And then by creating a crisis to show that perhaps those behaviors could be reversed. And the crisis in the New York experiment was that Sharif planned to actually set a forest fire and have these kids join together to fight it, which luckily never happened because the experiment fell apart before then. And so he was stuck. Rockefeller was writing to him saying, okay, what are you finding here about human nature? And he didn't have anything to show them. So with the bit of money that was left, he cobbled together an experiment in the southwest of the United States. And this time he made sure he got the results he wanted. And in fact, when he didn't, he faked the data. And the Robber's Cave experiment exploded on the scene right, as I say, around the time of William Golding's novel Lord of the Flies, and it seemed to show a very, very similar pattern. But in fact, the pattern it was showing was a carefully orchestrated drama that Sharif had put on and then published. And the interesting thing about these experiments we've been talking about, Milgram and Zimbardo's prison experiment and so on, is they still fetch up to this day in the social psychological textbooks that are given to undergraduates. And very seldom do the many methodological and ethical criticisms that have emerged in the literature, very seldom do those make it into print. So the students are taught these things as though they are received truth, when in fact, almost all of them are heavily influenced by the people who set the programs up.
And presumably also we have to think about who was funding them. So you mentioned Rockefeller. I wonder what that institution's interest was there. We're talking about the 50s to the 70s, which was also a boom time for advertising and like the commercial sector. Does that come into it at all?
Well, the interesting thing is that psychology as an academic discipline and as an enterprise grows massively after World War II. It does so partly as a result of the wartime breakdown of soldiers in combat, which is not shell shock this time around, but combat fatigue or combat neurosis. And that really fuels the rise of clinical psychology, a psychology that claims to intervene. Now, Rockefeller Foundation, interestingly, during the 1930s, had made its major priority in funding medical research psychiatry, which is a very odd choice because it was such a, you know, it was really the orphan of medicine in lots of ways. And after World War II, as federal funding starts to be available in increasingly large amounts, it tends to replace the big foundations, and a lot of it in the mental health area goes to psychology rather than to psychiatry. Now, Rockefeller is also very disappointed with the effects of 15 years of funding psychiatry. So you see in their records in the late 1940s a turning away from it, even a changing of the guard. The man who's run their medical programs, Alan Gregg, is sort of pushed aside. And Chester Barnard, who's now become the head of the foundation, thinks this is all a bit of a racket. And so the money tends to start being directed more towards social sciences, towards psychology. And there's a great deal of interest in in the basics of human personality and also the ways in which they can be manipulated. Remember, this is also the time of the Manchurian candidate. Yeah. I don't think the Rockefeller people are malignly manipulating this research. They fund it because it seems an interesting way of probing what people's natural capacities are. It's the same, in a way, Sharif is imagining the same sorts of things as William Golding is. And you could say, well, it's a very clever production. It's like almost like a play that's conducted over a period of weeks in real time and using amateur actors, and he gets them to do most of what he wants.
But is the lesson in the end, Andrew, of all these things that human beings aren't quite as bad as advertised, they're not quite as controllable as advertised, because all of these experiments, they set up a narrative which is that people can be made to do inhuman things or awful things. Yes. And generally speaking, they can be taken a long way. It never quite reduces to that type of savagery.
Exactly. And what we see here is, for example, in the Robber's Cave experiment, the boys suss out that it's the adults who are behind these things. So they have a baseball game, and the umpiring is deliberately biased so that one team is going to suffer a loss that's grossly unfair. And that's meant to set the other team against the other boys thinking they're cheating. But in fact, the boys realize that it's the umpires, the referees, if you like to use their different sporting technology, who are the ones who are crooked, and they start yelling, "Kill the umpires." So they know what's going on. And actually, if you look at the Milgram experiments, a lot of people resist And that's the kind of data that was suppressed in Milgram's reports about the experiments. And it's the thing that Gina Perry, in her previous book about Milgram, exposed really pretty thoroughly, that people did actually exhibit signs of gross discomfort. There were a lot of people who refused to go along with what they were ordered to do. And all the concentration was on the people who did the bad things. This prison experiment, the same thing. There'd just been this horrendous publicity about Attica, where the guards had been brutally violent in the prison, and then that created a counter reaction for the prisoners. So when those kids were recruited to that, they sort of went in with, well, the prisoners tend to behave this way in prisons and the guards that way. And then Zimbardo actually actively sort of coached the boys who were acting as guards to act the way he wanted, and then announced this sort of was the natural emergence. It wasn't natural at all. It was actually a created event. And so these experiments, yes, over and over, the Milgram experiment, everybody hears about it, and everybody hears that we obey authority unquestioningly. And actually, if you look at the data, that's not what that experiment shows. Yet over and over again, it's entered the folk knowledge of all of us, and we tend to believe it. So when we see Abu Ghraib, for example, we go, oh, that's the Milgram experiment again. And the other thing about that, I would say, is this is tremendous leap from these completely artificial environments to claims that these sorts of things happen on a grand scale in a very different kind of context.
Well, and talking about artificial environments and indeed gross discomfort and bad things, tell us about Martin Seligman's experiments in the 60s with dogs.
Yes, well, at least in Seligman's telling, until that period when he was still a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania, psychology was dominated by behaviorism, by the sort of Skinner operant conditioning, stimulus and response and negative reinforcements and producing behaviors and so on. And Seligman and one of his friends conceived the notion, which was around in the air at that time, that perhaps things were more complicated, that perhaps there was a cognitive dimension even to the way animals behave. And so what he tried to do with his dogs was to create what he called learned helplessness. So selected a group of dogs, shot them so that they reacted to a certain stimulus, expecting a shock. When they were shown something, they reacted because they were expecting a painful electrical current through their paws. And then he used what was called a shuttle box, where the animal could escape the negative stimulus, in this case the shock, by just jumping over a barrier to the other side of the box. But some of these dogs had been shown that they could escape the nasty shock. Some dogs were shocked no matter what happened. Whatever they did, they got a shock. Those dogs just sat there and cried and didn't try to escape the shock. So hence the notion that of learned helplessness. And what Seligman and his partner did is extrapolate from that and say, well, that was akin to the way humans behave when they're depressed. They become withdrawn, their thoughts cycle constantly in negative patterns. They're incapable of moving forward and getting out of the kind of vicious circle that they're trapped in. So that was an experiment that received quite a lot of publicity. It boosted Seligman's career. It was a kind of clever laboratory experiment that seemed quite powerful at the time. Oddly enough, many decades later, his collaborator in this experiment, whose name is escaping me, of course, at my age, he reversed the experiment and said, no, learned helplessness is our natural condition, and what we have to be taught is ways to move forward. Anyway, but learned helplessness seemed a very powerful metaphor for depression, and it turns out that in the late 70s and particularly in the 80s, depression was becoming sort of the common cold of psychiatry. It was becoming something that was seemed to be everywhere. So this model, this psychological model of where depression might come from, this sense of helplessness, and perhaps an intervention that persuaded people they could actually help themselves, that seemed very powerful for a while. So it made Seligman quite prominent, and it made him part of the mainstream of academic psychiatry, which was a discipline very much based in the laboratory, wanting findings that had the patina of science.
So it was attractive to gurus. This is what he became. He became, instead of a clinician, he becomes someone who wants to encourage happiness as an aim, and that's then pervaded a lot of the political thinking of the world.
Yes. What Seligman does a bit later is realize that this market among the clinical folks in his profession is a very large one, and that also he's somebody who can write easily for a general audience. And as you will know, being in the business of reviewing books, the books that sell in extraordinary quantities are these kind of self-help manuals and these how to discover what your personality is and how to make yourself a better person. Seligman discovers that if he abandons the laboratory approach and he embraces so-called interventions, he can make himself very rich and attract a very large following. And he becomes known as the happiness guru. And because he's a man with an enormous ego, he claims to have completely reoriented psychology. And he attracts not just a vast audience buying his books, but he attracts politicians like Sarkozy and your own David Cameron, who announces he's going to measure happiness and see, you know, judge his policies by whether Britain becomes a place with a better gross national happiness index.
I think we've possibly moved past that now. I think we just want Britain to keep the lights on for the next couple of years. That idyll of worrying about happiness in that sense is probably the past. Andrew, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Dick. Thank you, Thea. It was lovely to chat.
Lovely to speak to you.
Bye.
Yeah, but there was that period when it's relatively new, and even in testing in schools, happiness is supposed to. And you can see there is a validity to it, that if you're looking for a sense of well-being. But that feels like a rather long time ago.
It does, doesn't it?
I mean, we're recording this in the day of sort of Brexit carnage in Parliament and the line. We shouldn't talk about Brexit, obviously.
But, no, let's.
But that Cameroonian regard for intangible happiness seems a long time ago.
But the fact that he would fall for a happiness guru also says a lot about him as a leader, I would think.
Your David Cameron, Thea.
My David Cameron. Not at all.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Andrew Scull and Boyd Tonkin. Get subscribing to the paper or buy a copy in those quaint little places called shops. The translation issue is full of little-known joys. Did you know, Thea? The answer to this must be no. Well, it certainly was for me, that the Yiddish poet Sutskever, were you familiar with that said poet?
Of course.
It's an amazing story. It's about his fascinating life. It was in Poland, I think. He escaped from the Nazis. And anyway, he had to cross a minefield, and he decided to cross it in poetic meter. Sometimes I walked in anapaests, sometimes in amphibrax, he said. And he was literally saved by poetry, because he moved according to rhythm and was not blown up. Isn't that a fascinating story?
That's amazing. I did not know that.
No, I did not know that. But
did you know that Natalia Ginzburg was a terrible singer?
No.
She was. In her own words, she was a yowler.
A yowler.
All these things you can learn in
the TLF. There's lots of bits of... I'm trying to get us to do this more on Instagram, actually. I want us to do the little facts. Because I always... When I'm reading the proofs, I tend to read a whole bulk of this in one go. And I was like, I try not to make that noise, if possible. I'm often
tempted.
I've heard
that coming from the corner.
Yeah, you did wonder. You did wonder. Next week, what are we going to do? Well, I think we're getting perilously close to talking about modernity, Thea, by looking at Reddit.
What?
The alt-right and advertising.
Yes.
So we'll try and bring some of that onto the podcast, and we'll try to find something old too. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Thank you. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.